still to this day, how I walk into a room is how he walked into a room.
Dog lovers, welcome to season 3 of Rescued by a Dog, the podcast about dogs who have actually saved their owners' lives. I'm Laura, an animal welfare advocate and author of the novel Not Just a Dog, and this week you're going to hear from the incredible Zach Scow, founder of the wonderful rescue organization Marley's Mutts. When doctors told Zach that he had less than 90 days to live due to alcohol-induced liver failure, his pup Marley decided that wasn't a good enough prognosis. Together, they worked to beat the odds. Today's episode is sponsored by IzzyStays.com, a hotel booking website for animal lovers. Izzy Stays thinks every dog should be as spoiled as yours, so they set up a free and easy way to send the sales commission from your hotel booking to animal welfare charities. Now let's listen to Zach tell us about the healing power of a dog's love.
Does it sound better now?
Oh my gosh, so much better. Hi. Thank you so much for being here to talk to me about dogs that have saved your life. I am thrilled to have you because I've been following your work for years and you're amazing. And I'm sure that whatever dogs have helped you are also amazing.
So many dogs. I mean, I know who we'll need to focus on, but almost too many to count.
Yeah, not surprised. Okay, well then, why don't you tell me what is the name of the dog that we're going to talk about today and what do they look like?
So the dog of record of note that we're talking about who saved my life and really provided the scaffolding within my, not only my spirit, but emotionally, almost physically too, was his name was Marley. And I don't know if you can see him, but that's him on my arm here. And he was a Rottweiler pit bull, and I got him from the Mojave Animal Shelter here in Kern County, and he was just but a puppy, and he was in the kennel with another little dog who ended up getting adopted by a trucker. And so Marley was left alone, this little black lead ball that he was just adorable. He was about 9 weeks old.
When you saw Marley at the shelter, how did you know that he was going to be your dog?
Because he was a puppy and he was a pit bull.
Cool. So it wasn't just him. It was just like, there's a puppy. I'll take that one.
My requirements were pretty minimum. I wanted a puppy that I could, you know, train and work with. And I wanted a bully breed dog. And he checked the boxes. And he was in a really far off shelter with virtually no, there was no social media then. And there was no way he would get adopted.
What was the moment like that you got Marley home? Like, was he like, this is my house?
Oh, I just always had him on my chest. He was so small. And I, he wasn't vaccinated either. So I was paranoid about him getting sick. So I carried him in a backpack at all times. I smuggled him wherever I went, literally wherever I went. He loved it. But he just got so big so quick. Yeah, he was great. He didn't even, he looked so fierce and he intimidated everybody, but he was a complete love. At the time I was a practicing drug addict and alcoholic. So, you know, I was searching for all the things that a dog can give you without necessarily knowing about it. You know, I needed desperately unconditional love. I needed to feel comforted, to feel believed in, to feel like I was enough mainly. And yeah, he pretty much gave me that from the get-go. He progressed to be, he was out of the womb a perfect dog, essentially. You know, he was very intimidating, black, tricolored, massive, 95 pounds, you know, just all muscle. Again, just like a exactly Rottweiler pit bull mix. And I like to say that, you know, male dogs or female dogs wanted to be with him. Male dogs wanted to be like him. And it applies for people too. It's like anytime we walked into a room, people would look at Marley and he had this stoicism to him. He moved with this calm confidence, this just stoic, confident trudge where he just walked with purpose wherever he was going. And he was imperturbable, you know, no dogs threw him off. He never started fights. He would literally break up fights with my pack. He really knew how to set the tone for a pack. He really knew how to keep the symbiotic harmony.
What was it like to be you at that time?
Oh boy. My life in 2002 when we got him was my life was, I was centrally preoccupied with alcohol and drugs. I had a deep seated loathing of myself that I'm sure is rooted in a lot of different aspects of my life. But I was really like at my worst at that point. I had been kicked out of a bunch of colleges. I was kind of home, trying to very wayward, you know, not knowing what to do with myself, not having any confidence that came naturally. You know, everything, every aspect of stability I might portray came only when I was drunk or on drugs, which was all the time. You know, I got in a car accident in 2003, broke my chest and my shoulder, you know, got a bad concussion and I rolled into a ravine, you know, flew off a cliff and rolled into a ravine. And that fast forward my drinking to 24 hours a day. So after with that injury with a broken sternum, it's really a challenging injury to heal from. And I didn't want to take pills and I was already so committed to alcohol that just became my daily was to start drinking as soon as I got up and drink until I went to bed. And after 6 months, after I finally healed, you know, I had this moment of clarity where I said, I'm going to try to get through this. I'm going to try to abstain from drinking. So I got myself, like any good drug addict, I got myself some weed, some pills. I was like, I'll take these and I won't drink, you know? And the physical withdrawals that I started to have, like almost immediately, were horrific. You know, I always had some withdrawal symptoms, you know, shaky, uneasy, anxious, nauseous, things like that. But that one day, you know, I was at the liquor store at 6 o'clock in the morning as soon as it opened because I had basically started going in the DTs. I was fully withdrawing and it was awful. That was my first, you know, and that was just that little window of like 12 hours that I didn't drink. It's not a very big window.
What is a DT?
Delirium tremens. It's the way your body reacts when your body becomes very accustomed to having alcohol in your system, both physiologically and emotionally. So I think some of the hardest aspects of going through, although the DTs are really a physical phenomenon or physiological phenomenon, one of the most challenging parts is the emotional coping with not having alcohol. The walls just closing around on you. You don't feel like you can do anything. Barely feel like you can breathe. You know, certainly not face other people or go about your day to day. There's this kind of, you know, constant shaky anxiety that becomes your, and it's very uncomfortable, if not unbearable. Like what that moment was for me was I told myself, you know, I tried to get through 24 hours without drinking. I obviously failed and had to fill myself up with alcohol. But that was a commitment to being an alcoholic. I mean, after I went to the liquor store and liquored up, I told myself, all right, I'm not going to do that again. I'm never going through that again. I'm going to figure out a way to drink and use for the rest of my life. I was 23.
That was where you were. Had you already made the decision to be a full-time alcoholic when you met Marley then? Was that after that?
It was just after we got Marley. I roamed around a little bit after that, like aimlessly trying to find my way, you know, and trying to do different things. I worked at the Improv for a number of years, worked at different bars, worked at, you know, just trying to provide for myself and find some sort of direction, which it never worked. And then, in 2008, I started to turn yellow and my eyes started to turn yellow and my skin, and I started to bruise everywhere and I started to cough up blood. I started to leak blood really from both ends. Started to get this huge, hard stomach, like with varicose veins on the side of my stomach, and my belly button herniated. And I didn't know what was happening to me, but I knew it had something to do with drinking. And I had no idea that I was going into liver failure. I went to the hospital. They took blood tests. The nurse came out and she held my hands and she's like, honey, I have something to tell you. You are in liver failure and you need to go to a hospital like immediately. Then I said, nah, just because I got hammered last night, you know, that's nothing. She goes, no, honey, this isn't like these aren't numbers that produce after an acute drinking episode. These are numbers that only manifest after committed alcoholism. So she said, you know, you need to go to a hospital immediately. And you know, essentially you need a liver transplant. And I didn't want to hear any of that. And I just shrugged it off. I mean, I felt terror inside of me, but I didn't think I could share it with anybody because that meant alcohol would be taken away from me. And if you take alcohol and drugs away from me, that's the end of my life, period. There's no distinguishing me. I didn't exist without alcohol, and there's no distinguishing me without, I didn't exist without it. Everything I did, the person I was, the people I, the personality I thought I was, what I thought people depended on in terms of my, who I was and what they needed me to be, what I needed me to be. Like, it's hard to describe the anxiety that overwhelms you when you don't have alcohol and you're physically, mentally, and spiritually addicted to alcohol and drugs. It is a, you know, it was literally removing my identity. I could not contemplate taking alcohol out of my life. It just, even with that kind of a diagnosis. So I just lied about it. I was an adult. It's not like my daddy came with me to the appointment. And then I tried to hide it for basically like several months.
So you went back to drinking like that day?
Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Did you have a job? Did your friends, were you able to move through your life somehow?
Yeah, I could really fake it so many of us alcoholics are total chameleons. We can fake everything about our existence. I mean, we are liars and we're putting on a mask the entire time. So you just get used to living as that mask, you know? And I did, I hit it extremely well. But when my skin started to turn yellow, I would just wear long sleeve shirts and I would sit outside in the sun. So I look kind of orange. I would just tan, quite literally. I would sit outside. I would always wear sunglasses. I wore long sleeve shirts, baggy, so you couldn't tell how big my stomach is. When your body, you get this thing called ascites when your body goes into liver or kidney failure, and your hepatic duct is pumping all of this bile and blood through your liver. And when that gets backed up, there's a lot of things that need to be processed that can't. So they find a way around. And they create portal hypertension or high blood pressure in your veins and arteries. And it starts to, everything that's not being processed leaks into your abdominal cavity. So you have this mass, you have this liquid that's accumulating in your abdominal cavity at all times. And fast forwarding to when I would be hospitalized, you know, they would drain that like every 3 days. I had a catheter in my back and they would suck all this stuff out. And I remember the nurse used to plop it on top of the counter basically to show me what I'd done to myself. She's like, this is what we, you know, leaders, they pull out of you. And just to, because if that ever got infected, if this mass of disgusting bile and blood gets infected, you die immediately. You go septic. And that's how a lot of people die in liver failure from simply kidney or liver failure. Their organs stop working, which is what I was going through. Esophageal varices is when the veins and arteries in your throat burst because there's so much tension in the blood and there's so much high blood pressure. So I had pulmonary esophageal varices as well. And then a lot of times you'll go septic in your stomach where that blood and bile is accumulating and you'll die that way. So there's a lot of ways you die. You die from blood poisoning, you know, with ammonia buildup in your bloodstream. There's all kinds of things that stop working when your liver and kidneys fail, you know.
Aren't you in pain?
It was extremely uncomfortable. It was, you know, lateral G's, like moving sideways when you have this stuff filled up in your system. It was very painful. And, you know, to back up a little bit, what would happen was I couldn't hide it from my dad anymore. You know, I was bleeding orally and rectally and, you know, I was vomiting blood. It's very hard to hide. And I was, you know, starting to have bouts of ammonia confusion where ammonia is building up on my brain. So, you know, you don't know where you are. You don't know who you are, what year it is. You lose your balance. There's all kinds of these strange symptoms that are accompanied with. So I ended up going to the hospital in Bakersfield Memorial Hospital. They immediately admitted me for a long-term stay. The doctor came in after running tests and just said, you know, to my dad, your son needs a liver transplant and he's not going to get one, you know, period. And they gave me less than 90 days to live. And you needed 6 months of sobriety just to qualify for a liver transplant. They wouldn't look at you, period, until you have that 6 months. So I just started to waste away at the hospital. They were doing frozen plasma transfusions on me to try to, what happens is your INR, your how thick your blood is radically diminished. Your blood is super thin. So you won't clot, you won't heal. You won't, if you get a cut, it'll just bleed. So they would do these constant frozen plasma transfusions to put new blood into me that was cold to try to coagulate my blood, to try to thicken it up. And none of it ever worked. Really, it was just pointless. It was, you're withering away at this hospital. We're going to manage your pain. And so I immediately got addicted to drugs. Like within 3 days, I was, addicted to Dilaudid and morphine. And along with that came paranoia, some cases rage, feeling, I already felt terribly sorry for myself, but that just took it to a next level. And then obviously just hounding nurses for drugs. You know, my central preoccupation at that point, you know, because I had gone through the first several days at the hospital, I don't remember because I went through alcohol withdrawal and I simply have no memory of it. And my kidneys were not doing okay. So it took them a few days to stabilize my kidneys. And when I came out of that, you know, it was just hopeless. There was never any point of hope. The only thing, the real only bit of hope was my dad. My dad he's an engineer. He would not give up. He would not take this diagnosis as the final chapter. Even when they were trying to send me home on hospice, all he cared about was getting me to a hospital that did liver transplant. And he was just like, if we can get in there, he'll, you know, smooth over the nurses or the transplant team, or he'll find a way to make it happen. After 6 weeks of being at Bakersfield Memorial and just dying a little more every day, just getting sicker and sicker and getting drained, and you know, I got a meeting with the comprehensive transplant program at Cedars, which is where I was born, and they're one of the 7 hospitals in California that does liver transplant. So she admitted me to the program. She said, we're going to do something that's going to shock you, but we are not going to admit you into the hospital because we will kill you. We are sending you home with your dad, and you need to stay near an emergency room because you're going to need it. But if we keep you here, you'll die. And because they knew the hospital policy is pain management. So I would be, you know, you're pumping these terrible drugs through your already terribly damaged liver and kidneys, pancreas. And I got so rapidly worse once I got admitted to the hospital that it really would have killed me. And all of a sudden we find ourselves at home with my dad taking care of me, and he's going, I don't know what, you know, and we just tried to stay alive.
Was he giving you drugs? Like, did they send you home with drugs?
He was taking me to the hospital, though. I knew exactly how to behave, how to act in terms of my pain level to get me down to the emergency room to get a shot. And then I would just suggest different hospitals so that they wouldn't recognize me. So for 4 or 5 days, we went to several different hospitals to get shot up with Dilaudid. And I remember one time they gave me morphine or Percocet or something. They gave me something aside from Dilaudid, and that pissed me off even more. I'll never forget that. Like, being more angry that they gave me something that didn't give me a fix, you know, when I needed it.
What did you feel when they told you you're going to die?
Nothing. I don't think I felt much of anything. I was very scared. I was very scared. And when I was coherent. But when I was in the hospital setting, I was either kind of happy-go-lucky or buried in drug-seeking, motivation and extremely angry about not being able to get the drugs I needed to feel better. The only way that I had any sort of mental peace away from the situation I was trying to cope with was with drugs. Because remember, I'm an alcoholic and an addict, so I couldn't cope with what was happening to me. I just simply did not know how to cope.
What were you? You said you were scared in your clear moments. What were you scared of?
Dying.
And is it just not existing that scared you, or was it leaving your people, your dogs? Like, what was it that scared you about dying?
I think it was all probably what most people would experience if confronted with death. You know, that rush of, I haven't done this, I haven't done that. What about this person who I love, or that person who I love? I have a twin brother who I feel almost like, a collaborative existence with. So that got to me from time to time. And then very obviously my dogs were a big part of it, but that wouldn't really enter into the equation until I got home. So when I got home from the hospital, my dogs became everything. You know, they became, cause I was on the toilet almost all day and I had to flush a lot of these. They took me off all my medication. So I had to flush a lot of drugs out of my system and, I had to go through withdrawals, which were 48 hours. That was more than, it was 2 days of losing my mind, of blood coming out of the ceilings and demons in the ceilings and demons behind my eyelids and God talking to me and telling me to kill myself, all kinds of terrible things. And if my dogs, like Marley was with me in bed that whole time, if he wouldn't have been with me, like rooting me, because I would just touch Marley and he was just this rock solid, just everything is going to be okay energy. And I would just touch him that whole time. I mean, I remember closing my eyes and just hearing these voices and then opening them and seeing demons in the ceiling and blood coming off the walls and then closing my eyes again and trying not to think about it. And then just touching him, going, oh, I'm here. I'm okay. Like I'm here. And he just would lay there with me all the time. And then I'd be in the bathroom all the time and the three of them would just line up on the floor with me. If I was vomiting, if I was, you know, whatever was happening in the bathroom, which is a lot of different things, they would just lay with me and be with me.
Was Marley anxious? Was he watching? What was he doing?
Never. No, he was, none of them were ever anxious. Marley was just driven. He was just intent. Not even driven is not the right word. He was just intent. He felt like he knew what he needed to do. And the best visual I have for like what they looked like during all this is when it was like a week after I'd gone through withdrawals or maybe a few days and I was just highly suicidal. So I was just really occupied with ending my life. You know, it was like the last thing I had control of. You know, the diagnosis was so firm. It wasn't like I felt like I was going to get better. You know, everyone had told me, you know, look, you're not going to make it. And the only way you're going to make it is with a liver transplant. You're not going to get one of those. So if you can survive 6 months, you'll get one. So when we left the hospital at Cedars, that was the only focus, was survive 6 months. And then you'll be able to qualify for a liver transplant. And that was a very hopeless goal. And I got really pathetic for several days, you know, really just spiraled down this, I'm going to die. And then, you know, one morning it was very early in the morning and I had pooped the bed and I had to try to clean it up. I was very weak, very, very weak. And so it was very early in the morning and I didn't want to wake up my dad because he'd been taking care of me up to that point. And, you know, so I walked by the mirror and I'm naked, but, you know, poopy. And I just couldn't, I was so astonished at this countenance in the mirror, you know, what was looking back at me. I just leaned into myself, staring at my eyes and staring at my, you know, these thick varicose veins on my stomach that were feeding this huge 9 months pregnant belly. And, you know, my hair was all falling out and I was completely yellow and purple. Like every square inch, my arms had so many needles in them and everything bruised. So I looked like I was 90. I looked like a very, very old person. And I was pretty vain too, you know, up to that point. And so you go, what? Who is that? Who is that? And how did all this happen? And I just broke down. I just really was like, oh God, take me. Like, I can't do that. I cannot do it. It wasn't like a moment of strength by myself. I was like, I just can't do this. This is not going to happen. I got no chance here, period. And then I looked over my dogs and they're all sitting by the toilet, which is where I normally was, all just lined up looking at me, just like everything was perfect. Like there was nothing wrong. And it was just another day. And I was gorgeous, you know, and not only was I gorgeous, but like everything was okay. They were just looking up at me like everything's fine. Like you're just Zach, you're just there and it's okay. You look like shit, but we see you, you know, we really see you. And that was a big moment, you know, that was a big, and then I got to thinking, you know, what happens to them if I go, you know, so that morning we didn't go back to bed. I just sat up and journaled that whole morning. And I remember thinking that I was going to die and someone was going to find my journal. And they're going to be like, we thought this guy was like reasonably intelligent. He can't write. He can't spell. His syntax is awful. Like, I was genuinely concerned that my last legacy would be this journal I just started. And people were going to think I was, you know, like, it was funny where your brain focuses. But that was the first day of the rest of my life. You know, we just made a commitment to try to be vulnerable about what we were experiencing and walk. Just make a commitment every day, no matter what, to put one foot in front of the other. No matter how cold it was, no matter how, and that when you're in liver failure, you're freezing. You go through really cold bouts. So I would bundle up with as much stuff as I could put on, and I would just go for these little walks as long as I could up in the mountains and try to find God, try to recognize the energy that brought me into this world and that was keeping me alive. And, you know, try to step out of the madness of my mind, you know, this constant record of you're not enough, you're not enough, you're not enough in a bunch of different ways. And, it was revelatory. It changed everything. You know, I started to listen to music. I started to write. I started to, get a little bit better. You know, I started to be able to cope with the pain more. I started to feel more comfortable in public, because I looked dead. Everyone, wherever I went, I had to go to meetings. I was on a liver card. I was on a liver transplant card. If I didn't go to meetings, I wouldn't get my transplant. And so, you know, I had to go, and I went all the time, but even alcoholics and addicts had a really hard time getting close to me because they thought I was going to die. And, so I just started to like embrace what I was going through. And, for once after 6 weeks in the hospital and a couple weeks of, you know, trying not to live when I got home. And then things just, if you graft it on a chart, it just, everything rapidly improved. Everything. You know, every morning we got up and journaled and walked. And then we got home and we did something else and then we walked. And then we did it and we walked.
When you say we, you I love how you're talking in this way. You're like, and so we just decided to keep going. Who is we in that story?
Oh, me and the dogs. Me and my multiple personalities.
And no, I figured it was your dogs. I just love that, like, the way you phrased it. I love, because you were like, we decided we were going to keep going. Like, they made the decision with you.
Yeah, we always felt like a unit. So we, you know, I'd been working with the Humane Society and a couple other organizations, like, for a couple of years prior to getting sick. And I started to ask for dogs. I started to bring dogs into my pack and started with one and two. Then it just kept growing. And I started to get creative with their writings and their pictures. So I started to take a bunch of images for all these dogs that needed homes. I started to print up, this is prior to social media. So I'm typing up their bios and I'm making them funny and stupid and just ridiculous and just trying to make them unique. And it worked. We started having a bunch of adoptions and we started being really successful. And I kept walking and I kept getting better. And my ascites started to go down and I stopped having to take enulose. So I wasn't having ammonia on my brain anymore. My all the sulfacyclates cycled out of my system. So I had all these blisters all from the knees down, all over my legs and feet where the sulfa was draining out of my system. So by taking me off of all these medications that were supposed to save my life, that's what saved my life was finding purpose in my dogs. You know, they gave me direction every morning. Every morning I knew exactly what to do. I knew to get up, to write, to walk, and then to advocate for these dogs. So whereas before my purpose was to like beat myself up, that might not have been my expressed purpose, but that's quite literally what I was doing every day, was just ripping into myself. And so, you know, my whole existence became focused on them. And I found creativity in that. I found purpose in that. I found joy in that. And, you know, people seemed to be really receptive. So then I started to get confidence. And, you know, in many cases, addiction and alcoholism are diseases of confidence, of self-esteem, you know, and my self-esteem was non-existent. It was inverse negative, you know, I started to get self-esteem. So, and I started to embrace what I looked like. And I started to talk as often to anyone that I could about what I was going through. And I started speaking at schools. I started speaking at meetings. I started speaking at sober livings and wherever. And basically by the time I got 6 months of sobriety, I went down there and I'll never forget, Dr. Tran came out and she's like, you know, we don't know what you've been doing or what makes your situation particularly unique, but whatever you're doing, keep doing it. Because, you know, as of right now, my MELD score, which is your model for end-stage liver disease score, if it's above 17, essentially, you're transplant eligible. Mine was 26 and a half. So I was transplant eligible for like a year. But by the time I got 6 months sobriety, it had fallen below that. So I didn't even qualify. So during my review to get me on the list, they said, you know, the good news is you don't have to be on the list. And who knows, if you keep doing this, maybe you'll just be okay.
You never got a transplant?
Nope.
Is your liver healed?
Yeah, I have what's called stage 3 fibrosis. So normally livers, once you're cirrhotic, once you have stage 4 cirrhosis, it's called end stage, E-N-D, because there's no, they don't even call it stage 4. It's end, just that's the end. But there's, if you're young, if you take care of yourself, if you're driven to alter everything about what goes into your body, there's potential to change. So the previous ideology or ethos around liver failure is that once you're cirrhotic, there's no reversing that. It's scar tissue, and you can't reverse scar tissue. It just is what it is. But mine regressed. I had considerable cirrhosis and, you know, end stage cirrhosis. And not only did it regress, I don't present as cirrhotic any longer. I have what's called stage 3 fibrosis. It's shrunk considerably. The fattiness is gone. And yeah, so as long as I continue to watch what I put in my body and consume foods and liquids and things that are good for liver function, it should be okay. Marley never even barked at things. He was exactly what I needed to emulate. The coolest thing about Marley is I lacked self-confidence. I didn't know how to put my chest forward and my shoulders back. I didn't know how to embrace life without alcohol. You know, so much of my courage and self-esteem came from alcohol and drugs. So I was completely rebuilding myself. And I needed an example outside of my father that I could emulate. And Marley was the entity to emulate. He just, by emulating him, I figured out how to, even if I was faking it, even if I didn't feel $1 million, but oftentimes, you know, if you lead, you know, the rest of you will follow. And it did. He taught me how to be confident. He taught me how to face fears, because I could go with him anywhere. I remember the first time I went out in public, I saw my drug dealer. And I'm like, it was in the cereal aisle at Albertsons. And I was like, I'm never going out again. One time I go out, I run into, like, I'm not leaving. This is, and the fear, it's hard to express to people. You know, you hear anxiety or social anxiety or nervousness or whatever. You go, oh, okay, yeah, we all deal with that. This is like paralyzing. This is borderline panic attack all the time. You're just revved, pegged at, I'm going to lose my mind at any moment. And Marley, he eliminated that variable. So whenever I had him with, I didn't feel that way. I didn't feel like, I felt like there was no room I couldn't walk into. Even though I might not have felt like $1 million, I was going to walk into that room no matter what. And always gave you something to talk about. You know, you never had that dead air. You didn't have to focus on me, this yellow sick person I was confounding to everybody, because there was like, what is this guy? What?
Can you tell me a moment or a day when you were, that was really happy when you were with Marley?
Yeah. I remember the first time, the first morning I could run. I hadn't been able to, you know, so when you're going through liver failure, you have a lot of things wrong with you. So I had radical edema, you know, my ankles and feet were enormous. I had blisters all over my feet. I was extremely weak. You know, when you're hospitalized for 6 weeks, you don't get out of bed. When you do, you're in a wheelchair. And so my muscles had atrophied. I weighed 40 pounds less than I weigh right now, you know, and I'm not a big guy. You know what I mean? I'm 5'11", but I'm slight. I remember, the first time we went for a run. I remember that because he got away.
What? What did he do?
Well, I tried to get confident, like, because all the other dogs would follow me. So the rest of the pack would follow me. So I'm like, I'm dropping the leashes and I'm check this out. We're running, baby. All right. And I was like, I'm free, you know? And then Marley saw a deer and he just disappeared. He ended up hiking up basically an entire mountain. And the only way I could follow him was I could hear him because he would charge through underbrush without thinking about it. I think he would just close his eyes and barrel through. And so he's running up a very large mountain. It's all thick scrub oak and underbrush and sage. So I'm just hearing him and I can see the plants moving as he's making his way up the hill. And then he's following different scents and he's just so excited to be off leash. He doesn't know what to do with himself. It was just freeing to be out, to be alive and to be able to get him because I didn't have the physical capability to do much of anything. I could barely wipe my butt, you know, so to go hike up a mountain after a 90 pound Rottweiler, I felt like I was returning to this, to a person.
What did he do when you saw him again? Like, what was his reaction?
He was just foaming at the mouth with elation and had like, his entire body was like a light green from being covered in sagebrush, like just covered. Probably the most fulfilling early moment with Marley was the first time I spoke at high school, you know, in front of 600 kids in the gymnasium, me sitting on a chair with a microphone going, I am going to die of a panic attack, right? I'm going to literally have a heart attack. I am so scared, you know? And yeah, and I wore like a suit or something like that. And we got through it and we did a really good job and we got invited back. And
was he with you at the podium? Yeah. You think you could have done that without him?
Never. No way. No way. No way. I think Marley always knew that he was setting the, that he was like aiding me in some way. I think he always knew that he was helping me. He always knew that he had a purpose wherever he was going. He had, you know, the most beautiful thing about him was this visceral reaction he conjured up in people of fear. Almost everyone's reaction to him for whatever reason was fear. And to watch them kind of be confronted with that and then open themselves up to him and accept his, you could just see people's prejudgment and maybe their tendency to prejudge in the future kind of go away. He changed so many perceptions for, and you got to remember this is from 2002 to 2015. So this is early days and he changed so many minds. So many people altered the way they prejudged breeds of dogs based on interacting with him. And I think altered their prejudgments of alcoholics and drug addicts.
If Marley were here and he understood human English, what would you like to say to him?
Ugh. Thank you for showing me the way. Thank you for showing me how to be. Still to this day, how I walk into a room is how he walked into a room.